policing, prosecuting, and the South Florida community after the guilty verdict in the Derek Chauvin trial. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. The killing of George Floyd sparked a nationwide reckoning of race, police, and social justice last spring and summer. Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin was convicted of murder this week in the case. We will talk with a South Florida police leader, a pastor, and criminologist. What changes in Miami after the guilty verdict in Minneapolis? What does the verdict mean to you? What does the guilty verdict mean for the social justice movement? Call us now, 800-743-9576, 800-743-9576, or at WLRN on Twitter. How can the dialogue George Floyd's murder led to continue in a constructive way? Our program is made possible by Willie the B-Man, Bee Removal Specialist. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week and for supporting public media. The trial of the former Minneapolis police officer for the killing of George Floyd last year came to an end this week. Derek Chauvin was found guilty by a jury on three charges relating to the death of Floyd. It was a killing that sparked demonstrations across the world last spring and summer, including here in South Florida, and led to the high-profile prosecution of a police officer who was then convicted of murder.
For us Black parents, us Black people, it gives us some hope. It gives us hope.
That's Peggy Ward Grant in Key West this week. She served as president of the NAACP for the city back in the 1990s. Chris Torres is a 23-year-old community organizer in Broward County. She was at home in Davie with her parents when she heard this week's verdict.
As far as like Derek Chauvin like being found guilty, it's a step. But I hope people don't like hear that and then stop marching and start movement and stop doing any of that.
So let's talk about this verdict and what it means for South Florida. What does it mean to you? What does this guilty verdict in Minneapolis mean for the social justice movement here in Miami? And what does it mean for policing? Share your thoughts and experiences with us here live on this Friday afternoon. 800-743-WLRN is our phone number. 800-743-9576. You can also send us your thoughts on Twitter. We're at WLRN. The George Floyd killing mobilized people all over the world to speak out and demonstrate against systemic racism and police violence. The verdict was seen by some as justice and closure of this case. How can the dialogue George Floyd's murder led to continue in a constructive way? Help us unpack all that with your phone calls today, 800-743-WLRN. Delrish Moss is with us, Florida International University police captain, public information officer, longtime law enforcement officer. Captain Moss, welcome back to WLRN. Nice to have you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You served in the Miami City Police Department. You were the police chief in Ferguson, Missouri, after Michael Brown was shot and killed by a police officer. Is there a broader message in this week's guilty verdict in Minneapolis for law enforcement?
Well, it's hard to say that if there's a broader message, because clearly we saw in this trial that Derek Chauvin was not acting under the policies of the police department, nor was he acting within the law. So it may send some message to police officers who think to run afoul of the law. I don't know that it resonates into a broader message for law enforcement.
Some South Florida police departments did change policies on neck restraints, for instance. Now, neck restraints not used on George Floyd, but local departments changed those policies last summer. How has this case influenced use of force policies and practices generally, do you think, or even how departments talk about them with the force?
Well, I think that, you know, clearly, whenever you see an incident of this magnitude, police departments will re-examine themselves. They will look at their policies and determine changes. But I think some of those changes were happening already. For instance, Florida International University, our policies had changed long before. And when I was chief back in Ferguson, back in 2016, we changed those policies. So while some were already doing it, others did react to seeing what they saw.
Captain Moss, stick with us. We've got you for a good number of minutes here, and we're going to add some more voices. Melvin Pinckney is one of those, bishop at New Life Zion Temple in Lake Worth Beach. Bishop Pinckney, welcome to the program. Thanks for your time today.
Well, thank you for having me.
You spoke with WLRN's Wilkin Brutus on Wednesday after the verdict. Let's listen to what you said then.
To be honest with you, I was very worried. I was torn, you know. I was just feeling like, Lord, don't let this go the wrong way. He was found guilty, as he should have been, and I thank God for that.
Bishop, share with us what worried you before this verdict in Minneapolis.
Well, for people of color, you know, and, you know, it's, you know, we've seen too much of this, even going way back to the Rodney King day. You know, we just saw police brutality. And I'm not against police. I'm not for defunding the police. We need our police officers. We need them. They do great work. But we all know there's bad apples in all bunches, and we got to wean them out. The Carly's going to have to wean them out, call them out, because we don't want to continue this track that we on with all of these killings. You know, I just policing is a tough job. I can't imagine, you know, having to make a decision in a quick second and all of that, because that's not what I do.
Bishop, the worries that you articulated there, have they dissipated at all with this verdict?
A little bit, you know, because I was saying to my wife, I said, man, if this go the wrong way, my faith in the justice system is out the window. You know, that's how I was feeling. I'm just being frank with you. I was feeling like, man, if this goes the wrong way, man, and we done saw footage, you know, what are my eyes lying to me now? My eyes are lying to me. Looking at this, and so where do I go? You know. Yeah.
Well, Bishop, I'll let you know we celebrate frank conversations here on WLRN, so I appreciate that frankness.
Yeah.
Stick with us, Bishop, and we're going to get to some callers here in a moment. Alexis Piquero is also with us, criminologist and chair of the University of Miami Department of Sociology and Arts and Sciences chair. Professor, welcome to the program. Thanks for sharing your perspective. Police policies are made locally by departments. How do you think this case impacts police procedures generally, and how police departments and other regulatory bodies will review use of force policies?
Hi, Tom. It's a pleasure to be with you and our guests here today. I think what we saw last May 25th is something that nobody else has ever seen, with the advantage of having that on social media. I think that forced every single police department to look internally to themselves to ensure that what they are doing is not consistent with what Derek Chauvin did. So I think you saw that immediately happen with chokeholds and other kinds of use of force tactics. I think there was a re-upping of de-escalation techniques, things that police departments had already been doing, but I think it magnified it and put a real big spotlight on the issue for all police departments. And I want to say, every single police chief I talked to, all the big city police chiefs I talked to, all of them decried what Chauvin did. That is in no way, any shape or form, any kind of routine or correct approach to dealing with an individual who is already detained.
Captain Moss mentioned earlier that some of these reform and review policies of use of force policies underway well before the tragic consequences and the murder of George Floyd a year ago in Minneapolis. Alexis, what's forward looking? What's ahead? What's the trajectory of those reviews? And has that trajectory been impacted by the verdict this week?
I think it has. The Derek Chauvin case is certainly not the typical use of force case that we see or we study in policing. As the bishop said, these are instantaneous, less than 1 second decisions for the most part. The Chauvin case is an atypical one. I think what you're going to see now, and independent of what happens or doesn't happen in Washington, because that's a whole other layer of issues, is I think we need to move towards some sort of standardization across as many departments as possible, and also to be as transparent as possible with respect to the data. So, for example, some police departments will put on their websites how many use of force incidents they had, what the outcomes of those are. I think that transparency is really important for the community, because the police and the community have to work in concert, because you need trust, and trust builds legitimacy, and you need legitimacy to have both sets of people working together.
Yeah. I would talk more about the role of trust in the community with our faith leader, Bishop Pinckney, who's along with us with New Life Zion Temple in Lake Worth Beach, as well as Delrish Moss, Florida International University police captain, longtime law enforcement officer in South Florida. We want to get to some of your phone calls, though. 800-743-9576. We're talking about the South Florida response to the guilty verdict against former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin in the murder of George Floyd last May. Of course, that led to a spark of marches, demonstrations, protests here in South Florida and across the world regarding racial, social, and economic justice. Your calls again, 800-743-9576. John in Miami, you're up first. John, thanks for calling. You're on the radio.
Yeah, hi, thanks. My only comment would be that I don't think this trial is going to have any effect on any kind of movement for racial or social justice, because race had nothing to do with it. It was never mentioned during the trial, and there was no evidence ever brought to bear that race had anything to do with what happened to Mr. Floyd. It's probably a bad police officer or whatever he was convicted, but there was nothing about race ever came out.
John, I appreciate that perspective, and to prompt that type of conversation. Bishop, I want to put that to you. As John mentioned, the role of race in terms of the court record is one thing. The role of race in terms of how society, communities viewed that murder is something wholly different, isn't it?
Oh, of course. Yes. Policing, as I stated, is a tough job. But going back to now, if we're going to talk about race, if these was, if that was a black officer and it happened to be a white gentleman, or these shootings, most of these shootings was black officers, policies would have been changed long time ago. They wouldn't have even been talking about changing them. They would have changed them, policies and procedures, and they would have changed those policies ASAP.
Alexis Picaro with the University of Miami, a criminologist, mentioned about the role of trust. Bishop Pinckney, how would you describe trust, the role of trust between your congregation, for instance, and the local law enforcement community?
Well, we getting ready right now to, in our city, we're working with PBSO and the community and the clergy. We trying to work together to get everyone on, one accord, because people are getting a little nervous about, because we having problems getting African-American police officers. It's predominantly white commission, predominantly white policing in our community. So it's being challenging.
You talk about PBS, that's the Police Benevolent Society?
Palm Beach, yeah, the Sheriff's Department.
Sheriff's Department, gotcha, Palm Beach, yes. Sheriff's Department, understood. Captain Moss, like your thoughts on this role of trust, and then also if you had any response to John, the caller in Miami, regarding the lack of a role of race in the official court proceeding, the prosecution of Derek Chauvin.
Well, with regard to trust, I think that's the only way you can actually get police work done. I mean, when there's trust, when there's legitimacy, it makes things run a whole lot smoother. When I was a homicide detective, for instance, I didn't get a lot of cases solved because I was a great detective. I got a lot of cases solved because people trusted me to give the information. They trusted me to give the information, and they trusted me to do the right thing. Now, with regard to race, while race was not brought to bear in that courtroom, there is no disputing the fact that race certainly is on the minds of many Americans because of the history here and because of the just the fabric of race is at the very fabric of our founding. And so while race may not have been a factor introduced in the court, there's no doubt that people sitting all across their living rooms, all across America, or all in their rooms across America, were not thinking about race, at least as a, if not a major factor, at the very least as a minor factor.
Alexis, as a criminologist, how do you hear John in Miami's observation?
It's an observation that I hear, and it's also an observation that a lot of people disagree with. And I think at the end of the day, I'm not, and our guests are not, or you're not, and John is not, in Derek Chauvin's head when he did what he did. Mm-hmm. So can I say definitively that race was on Derek Chauvin's mind? No, I can't. But it's almost inconsequential if it was, because what he did was wrong, and what the community saw is a replaying of an optic over and over and over again. White officer, black suspect. And so that's the image that people have on their mind. So, you know, whether or not Chauvin did that because he had certain nefarious intentions that were motivated by race, it's almost immaterial, because the community sees that now as that's how use of force is in America. And that's a big problem, because even if that's not reality, that's what people perceive. And we need to get that perception down.
And this issue of trust that you thankfully introduced here early on in this conversation, Alexis, what are the tools that law enforcement departments are using, and the tools that community groups are using to recognize trust as a really fundamental cornerstone issue and engender it?
So we have to tone down the volume among everybody. All right. We have to tone down the volume of let's eliminate the police, as the bishop said, or defund the police. We need the police in some capacity. Now, we have to reimagine what the police role is, because police departments have gotten more and more things put upon them. So independent of that, there needs to be communication. So community boards that work with the police department, not isolated from the police department, transparency, people having conversations and meetings, letting people see the inner workings of the police department so people can see what the role of those officers are on a day-to-day basis. The more we can have people at the table, the more we will have trust, and trust builds legitimacy. And that's the bedrock of any effective police community partnership.
We are talking about the guilty verdict against former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin in the murder of George Floyd last May, and how that has resonated and reverberated across the world, including here in Miami and South Florida. Helpless Delta sent us this tweet. What we need to do is reassess our approach to public safety. We have a fire department for fires, ambulances for medical emergencies, but for all other public safety events, we're forced to call armed agents to resolve these situations. Delrish Moss is with us, captain of the Florida International University Police Department, and longtime law enforcement officer, former police chief in Ferguson, Missouri. Captain Moss, you hear there from one of our listeners on Twitter, and that had been a part of the conversation, part of the more, I suppose, sophisticated conversation last summer regarding the so-called defund the police, rather, the reallocation of resources toward other types of agencies involved in public safety. Is that still a meaningful place for the community conversation to be?
Well, it's certainly a meaningful place, and it's not a new conversation. You know, back in 1971, the Miami Police Department started a public service aid program where they actually send people out to handle non-emergency calls for police service who are unarmed. In fact, that's how I started my career. So that's always been one of the thoughts. But I think that you're right in that police departments have been asked to do a lot more. For instance, we're asked to deal with people who are having challenges with regard to mental health. And while we do go through training, if a psychiatrist who's gone to medical school and gone to all sorts of schooling can't handle that situation, what are we going to do with a 40-hour course? While it may help, that should certainly not be at the forefront of our purview in terms of response.
Pastor Pinckney, how about you have referenced multiple times the difficult job that law enforcement officers face, those split-second decisions that they have to make on the job. How about that conversation beyond the defund the police rhetoric, as Alexis points out, needs to kind of cool down here, but the job that the public is asking and demanding of police departments and how police departments have been organized and budgeted to respond to those demands. Pastor Pinckney, did we drop you on the call? I think we may have. He may have dropped out of our Zoom audio. We will try to get the pastor back in a moment. Alexis, let me bring you back into that conversation here. As you mentioned, right, cooling that rhetoric. You heard Captain Moss's early experience of how he got involved in law enforcement. Is there a broader return to that type of policing that that agencies are and their municipalities are beginning to have really financial conversations, right, under the idea of show me your budget, and that's what you're going to show what you care about, where your priorities are?
Yeah, I don't like making decisions based on money, especially for public safety personnel, whether it's firefighters, police officers, medical technicians and nurses. I think we need those kinds of roles in society, and we need to staff them appropriately with the kinds of resources they need. There's always going to be a need for those sets of individuals. And so I think that returning to the Officer Moss's point earlier, and something I agree with, is that a lot has been put onto police. So a lot of the calls that police deal with are calls for homelessness, are calls for mental health crises, are calls for domestic violence incidences. And a lot of the training that police officers do is not necessarily geared toward how do you deal with someone who is going through a crisis, especially when you show up and you don't know what's on the other side of that door or what that individual has gone through. So what some departments are doing now is they're teaming up with mental health counselors on certain kinds of police calls, and that's showing some nice promise in places like Oregon and some other cities. But also, to return back to what the pastor's point earlier was about the faith community being involved with the police department, a very early project in Boston called the Boston Gun Project brought together social services, mental health, the city, the education sector, the employment sector, and the faith community, and ex-gang members to all work together to stem the tide of violence in Boston. And that program is being replicated, including here in Miami. And the idea is that public safety is an issue for everybody. So we all have to be vested and we all have to care.
Yeah. Yeah. Captain Moss, how about that point? After all, the first word in public safety is public. How do you assess the role of the public and the community in that effort?
Well, I love the fact that the Boston 10-point plan was brought up, because that is a plan that while I was in Ferguson, we worked really hard to try to replicate, because it does take into account that everyone's job is public safety. It's not just the police. It's not just us coming out, that all areas of service should be geared toward that. And the public should definitely be at the forefront in terms of that conversation. After all, these are local municipalities who get their marching orders from their communities.
And that plan, give us a quick sense of that plan, how it was articulated in Ferguson during your time there.
Well, one of the things that we did in Ferguson was we put in place, with the help of Washington University, a police social worker program, where we actually brought in social workers to work with the department to actually get to the root causes of some issues that led to crime. Sometimes we get there at the end, but if we can start to deal with some of the issues like poverty, like lack of opportunity and all these other things on the front end, then they don't become police challenges on the back end. And so while we are talking about the reformation of police, we should be looking at society as a whole and trying to figure out what those other components can do better to keep things from becoming our problem.
Captain Moss, stick with us. We want to continue our conversation. Delrish Moss, Florida International University police captain, public information officer. Alexis Piquero is also with us, criminologist, chair of the University of Miami Department of Sociology. And we are trying to get back our faith leader here on the telephone. As soon as we're reconnected, we will welcome back Melvin Pinckney, bishop at New Life Zion Temple in Lake Worth Beach. We want to hear from you. How does that conversation that was sparked after the death of George Floyd last May continue after the guilty verdict of the police officer involved in his killing. 800-743-9576. 800-743-WLRN. South Florida Roundup will continue in a moment. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. We're talking about the verdict in the trial of Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis. He was a police officer who was convicted this week of murdering George Floyd in May. It sparked marches and protests and a broader reckoning of social justice in Miami and across the globe. 800-743-9576 to join our conversation and your perspective. 800-743-9576. Delrish Moss is still with us, Florida International University police captain and the public information officer there. He used to serve in the city of Miami Police Force and was also police chief in Ferguson, Missouri. Alexis Piquero is also still with us, criminologist and the chair of the University of Miami Department of Sociology. Captain Moss, you grew up in Miami. You came of age in Miami. You started your law enforcement career in Miami. How can the dialogue around the racial and social economic justice that George Floyd's murder led to continue in South Florida in a constructive way after the guilty verdict of Derek Chauvin this week?
Well, I think one way is even conversations like this, but on a broader scale, I think that from a police perspective, we've actually got to get out and talk about, and I mean, talk to our community about the things that they want from us and the things that we can do better. We have to listen. We have to adjust with those conversations. But I think the conversation of race is one that's going to be with us for a long time. And so finding ways to bring down that rhetoric, to tone down the heat and have those conversations is to all of our advantage. Because it's very real, and it's not just in policing; it's in all facets of our community, from my ability to get a loan to where I live, and all of those things are a factor. And so, I think we should be having this conversation in a constructive way, where we're not yelling, but we're certainly trying to figure out solutions forward.
Take us into those conversations as comfortable as you can, Captain Moss, inside the force. Most people are not police officers, right? Most people don't have direct experience operating as a police officer or a law enforcement officer or a public safety officer. We may encounter them in public in times of need and distress, highly emotional and vulnerable times, certainly. But that conversation you speak about in terms of race, especially Captain Moss, how do forces themselves have those conversations?
Well, one of the things we talk about most times is sensitivity training. But I'll tell you, from Florida International University's police department standpoint, Chief Casas was very good at having us put together kind of the history of race relations in South Florida with its police. And in talking about that history, we're giving officers who haven't experienced this, haven't had a concept of what the relationship between police and society, especially the Black community has been, has really started to give them an understanding that leads to a greater sensitivity when you know why people are having this conversation, why people feel angst when police show up. When you know these things, you can better respond. And so one of the things that we've been doing in the police department here is trying to help young police officers have a better understanding of what that dynamic has been, the evolution of it, and how we move forward.
Coming up in a few moments, we're going to be talking with documentarian who produced a film regarding the 1979 killing of Arthur Lee McDuffie, which led to the 1980 uprising in Liberty City and elsewhere. Are these history lessons the kinds that you're talking about, Captain Moss?
These are exactly the type of history lessons that we're talking about. When you understand your history, when you understand where you've been, and you understand why there is a divide, well, the first thing you can do is start to work to do things to minimize that divide and work to figure out ways to move forward in a way that brings us all at the table, not as enemies, but as people trying to find solutions.
Alexis Piquero, I'm a criminologist at the University of Miami. I'm fascinated by what Captain Moss is telling us here. We think about continued, you know, professional training for law enforcement regarding, you know, legal doctrine, use of force, policies, practices. hadn't thought about history lessons as part of that continued training.
Yeah, I think the Derek Chauvin case will be part of a lot of curriculums, not just in my classrooms, but also in police academy and trainings. And one of the important things I think that the chief also will agree upon is that these trainings aren't 40 hours and you're done forever. You know, we need them like booster shots. And a good example of this is something that the Miami Heat partnered with Dedicated to Community sometime last fall in the Miami Police Department, where they had a nonprofit who does these kinds of conversation trainings. Now, I'm not going to talk about use of force trainings or de-escalation trainings or racial justice trainings. They're trainings about interactions with police officers and community members. And at one of the first trainings that I actually went to, they had members from the faith community. They had members from the community. And the idea is that those kinds of trainings will be regular for the Miami PD going forward. And I think it's really great that the Miami Heat recognizes the importance of this issue, partners with another agency, a nonprofit group, working with the police department, getting that message out. And so that's one of those things, is that, you know, we're going to have these conversations, you know, and I hope we never have them again, but we're going to have them again. And we have to do the best we can to learn from the mistakes of the past, but those mistakes will be teaching lessons going forward.
Many institutions launched racial equity efforts last summer in light of the protests that were ignited by the killing of George Floyd, now the murder as ruled by a jury, including Florida International University. Captain Moss, as the police captain there of the police force at FIU, what role does law enforcement have in those racial equity efforts?
Well, when we started the Equity Action Initiative here at Florida International University, myself, along with Elpanye Hudson and Dr. Valerie Patterson, were sort of the team that was put together to actually start to study the issue. And we consulted with people far and wide, internal and external, to the university to kind of figure out every facet of what we were doing here. Now, while police were only a part of that, the part that dealt with police actually centered around policies, conversations, and even looking at how, you know, the things that our university community want from us. And so police have a very big part of that, but they can't be the only part, because mm-hmm. these are far deeper than just police relations.
Certainly not. And in fact, back to Alexis's comment regarding the Miami Heat, we saw other, I'm going to call the Miami Heat an institution here in South Florida. I mean, it is, after all, the NBA franchise that we rally around. What role do those organizations, private organizations, not government agencies, but private organizations, play in this constructive conversation?
Well, certainly it's a huge role. I think it was very courageous for the Miami Heat to partner with the Miami Police Department. And, when I was at the Miami Police Department, I left there running the community relations section of the department. And one of the things that we tried to do was partner far and wide, because, like I said, we're talking about reforming police. But one of the things that scratches just below the surface is there has to be a deeper reforming of even how we deliver police services and how we view what is expected of us. And so having partners in this is always hugely important, because one, they have the audience; two, they have resources that we don't necessarily have; and three, they bring with them some legitimacy that we may not, in segments that we may not have.
Captain Delrish Moss with Florida International University, Alexis Picaro, criminologist at the University of Miami. Unfortunately, we have not been able to reestablish our connection with Bishop Melvin Pinckney with New Life Zion Temple in Lake Worth Beach. Our apologies to him. Let's go to a phone call here. Max in Miami is listening in. Go ahead, Max. You're on the radio.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking the call.
Thank you for calling.
I'm listening to the panelists and the statements that everyone is making, and they all have fantastic points. Captain Moss has been touching on something that I have practiced as a former police officer here in Florida, on the West Coast, and it was, the acronym was COP, C-O-P, Community-Oriented Policing. That's something that I think as law enforcement we need to get back into, but the community needs the opportunity also to understand what it's like to be an officer in today's society. And I think once you have that understanding, and like Captain Law said, that goes directly to the trust factor. Communication plus trust will equal success. So I don't know why it's so difficult as a society to look at this from both sides and to come to some sort of an agreement that we can address, where we can address these issues, because absolutely, it is killing us.
Yeah. Max, are you still active duty law enforcement?
I am not.
You are
I'm
not.
A former officer and medic and firefighter. So I've seen the issues from both sides. You know, being a black man here in South Florida, it's not easy. And when I went to work, I was being pulled in many different directions, and it was difficult for me to handle those fluctuations.
Hmm. Max, I appreciate you listening and sharing your perspective. Important to hear your voice. Thanks.
Oh, thank you very much for taking the call.
Yeah. Captain Moss, how about community policing? And I want to hear, Alexis, from you as well. This is not a new concept, not a new practice. It dates back a good number of decades, and there has been a lot of research around community policing and kind of how it gets articulated. What's the 21st century definition of community policing?
Well, look, I think the 21st century definition of policing is very similar to the older definition of community policing. It's about building trust and legitimacy. It's about working with your community partners and community individuals to actually come up with better solutions to address problems. You know, so I don't think that that has changed. I think
what does it mean on the ground, though? Pardon the interruption, Captain. What does it mean in the community, in the neighborhoods, on the blocks, on the sidewalks?
You know, I'll give you. So there are lots of definitions of what it means,
right,
on the blocks. For instance, one of the things that Miami did many years ago was it divided its city up into 13 major areas, and they provided a neighborhood, a net commander for each of those neighborhoods to actually address, work with the people in that particular neighborhood to work with problems that were unique to that neighborhood and try and find ways to solve them. They also put in that equation other city services, as well as faith-based organizations, as well as nonprofit organizations and all these other things, to all come up with solutions that are prescriptive to the problems in that particular neighborhood. By the same token, you had the community relations section that would come in and enhance that with what we called at that time crime prevention specialists, or before that they were called, there was another name for them. But that came right out of the 1980 riots, when we realized that the police didn't have real good relationships with a lot of people in the community. And so they created a system of people who were not police officers, but worked as liaisons with the police department to actually build those bridges.
You
and so a lot of moving parts to this, and for every neighborhood, it's different.
You mentioned 1980. In fact, we're going to be talking just about the legacy of the McDuffie killing and the acquittal of the four police officers that were charged with killing Arthur McDuffie in December 1979 in Miami in just a moment. But first, let's thank our guests here, Captain Delrish Moss with Florida International University Police Force. Captain Moss, always great to have you on WLRN. Thanks for sharing your perspective.
My absolute pleasure.
Alexis Picaro, criminologist and chair of the University of Miami Department of Sociology. Professor, thanks for sharing your research as well.
Pleasure to be here, everybody.
Great to have the conversation with each of you. Thanks so much. Still to come on the South Florida Roundup, we're not done yet. We are going to talk about the legacy of the Arthur McDuffie case, a black man beaten, killed by white officers in Miami in 1979 who were found not guilty. That's coming up. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. More than 40 years ago, Miami erupted following the killing of Arthur Lee McDuffie by Miami-Dade police. McDuffie was 33 years old. He was an insurance agent and Marine Corps veteran. He was beaten into a coma by white Dade County police officers after he ran a red light on his motorcycle. He died several days later from his injuries. An investigation led to arrests and a prosecution. A judge moved the case to Tampa, where an all-white jury acquitted the officers, prompting public outcry, and in May 1980, the McDuffie Uprising in Miami. Last year, a Miami-based filmmaker, Dudley Alexis, made When Liberty Burns, a documentary film that highlights the life and death of McDuffie.
I think a lot of young people have no idea what McDuffie was. No idea. And as a matter of fact, I don't think it. I know it. The older people, it has a lasting effect, I think.
This is where the chase ended, and here is where the questions begin. McDuffie crashed his motorcycle, but some of the wounds he sustained are not consistent with the accident.
Some substantial use of force was used at the scene after the chase, and the subject died of critical injuries resulting from that use of force.
People just exploded. It was almost like someone had gone along and struck a match.
Dudley Alexis joins us now along with Lonnie Lawrence. Lawrence was a friend of McDuffie's. He's also a retired Miami-Dade Corrections Department director and public information officer. So let's talk about the McDuffie story. What are your thoughts about the legacy here, even after the guilty verdict in Minneapolis in the George Floyd killing? 800-743-WLRN, our phone number, 800-743-9576. Dudley and Lonnie, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Lonnie,
thank you for having me.
Lonnie, I'd like to start with you. What do you make of the Derek Chauvin guilty verdict?
Well, I think that what happened was, for the most part, people believe what they saw. You know, and you talked about the difference, the difference between the McDuffie situation and this one is that there was video. Mm-hmm. There was actually someone taking video of what actually happened. We never saw what happened. In the McDuffie case, we know what happened, but we didn't see it.
Yeah. After the verdict this week, some people referenced McDuffie's name as a black person killed by police who were not prosecuted or were found not guilty. What do you think about those references to your friend?
Well, I mean, you know, Duff and I, his name will always stay in the front of my mind, but I think the references to it are legitimate references in the sense that it points out inequality in terms of what happens in cases of some black men compared to others. And, you know, I think the difference, once again, is that this jury decided to not back away from doing what needed to be done and did what they needed to do.
Hmm. Dudley Alexis, the filmmaker, does the Chauvin guilty verdict change the framing around the McDuffie story, do you think?
I would not say that. To me, it was kind of interesting for me to actually try to describe how I felt about the Chauvin guilty plea, because I felt like it's a moment I should not be, that should be guaranteed, you know, George Floyd was going to get justice, but it wasn't guaranteed. And still today, we don't know if it's going to be guaranteed for the next person, because it's a moment I feel like we're reflecting on and see how it's going to be played in the next few years. How are we going to translate that moment? So, and I think in many ways, a wait and see how we're going to take that moment, what changes we decide to do and how, because what's happening is it's a much bigger problem than just policing.
Your film takes a look back at the McDuffie uprising, the McDuffie case, as documentary films do. They look back through history through it. The Chauvin verdict here has the George Floyd killing, first of all, causing, you know, a reckoning and protests, demonstrations, marches, and then the Chauvin guilty verdict. To revisit the McDuffie story today in light of the guilty verdict, Dudley, how do you think people ought to think about what happened in December 1979 and the trial in Tampa and then the uprising in Liberty City after the not guilty verdicts?
You know, one thing I focus on in telling the story of our Arthur Lee McDuffie is his relationship with the city. In many ways, the relationship of Black people with in America in general, it's that relationship I think we need to look at and see what how we want that relationship to go forward and how we want to deal with that in the future. So, so I want that's pretty much what I want people to look at is like study that relationship and try to understand that relationship and see what we need to be fixed, not what to fix.
Lonnie, go ahead.
I was going to say, I know we have to be careful not to try to draw parallels between the different cases. You know, we need to look at, and I think Dudley said it, we need to look at the whole picture. And the question becomes, did anything change from 1980? Mm-hmm. And will anything change from 2021? You know, what has changed? Will there be any difference in how police relate to Black and brown communities as opposed to others? You know, will there be any change in how the criminal justice system as a whole deal with it? So I think we have to be careful with trying to draw parallels because, you know, quite frankly, they were two different situations. Mm-hmm. We had two different outcomes, obviously, but it's nothing to get, in my mind, it's nothing to get excited about because that doesn't go to the root of the problem, and that is the relationship between Black and brown folk and the criminal justice system as a whole.
Lonnie, you pose an incredibly important question. In the 40 plus years since the death of your friend, where do you look to find answers of whether or not anything has changed since the death of Arthur McDuffie?
Well, I think everybody has to be willing to be accountable. I think everybody has to be willing to accept some accountability. You know, and let me just say this because I've heard a lot of talk about, well, you know, if Arthur had not run, it would not have happened. And if Floyd had just laid there, it would not have happened. Well, let's remember that neither one of the charges involved in either one of these cases can result in a death sentence. Neither one.
Right, yeah. Lonnie and Dudley, we have to leave it there, but I do appreciate you sharing your perspectives. Awfully important to hear. Lonnie Lawrence with us and Dudley Alexis. Thanks again for joining us here on the South Florida Roundup this week.
I wanted to say, you know, we have like a free screening of When Liberty Burns coming at the Lyric Theater on May 15 and May 16. So first come, first serve.
Great.
So if anyone want to catch the documentary and see it.
Great to know. Thanks for squeezing that in. Dudley Alexis here on the South Florida Roundup. Thanks to both of you. Finally in the Roundup this week, poetry and your postal code, an ode to your zip code. We partnered again this year in April with the O Miami Poetry Festival to invite you to write an ode to your zip code. April, after all, is National Poetry Month. Now, the rules are simple. You just use your five-digit zip code to write a five-line poem. Each digit of your zip code determines how many words per line. We've got a handy-dandy tool for you at wlrn.org/zipodes to help get you started. You can write one by yourself, or you can make it a family project.
Sarah and Sam Kaplan, Zip Ode, 33141. On the sea, bed of grass, palm, party boat with dancing girls, calm,
Hey, this is Kelly from Oakland Park, and my zip code is 33334. Here's my ode to my zip code. 4 years later, I know dogs. Bella, Daisy, Nacho, Molly, Oreo, Leche. Few people's names, though.
Criatura que nada entre tinieblas del agua. No pierdas fe. Nuestra bahía será tu cárcel y mundo entero.
Creature that swims in the water mists, don't lose faith. Our bay will be your jail and entire world. That was Shamina Maria from 33138. Now, WLRN and O-Miami will celebrate Zip Odes with a virtual event next week on Wednesday. Be sure to check out our social media for the details to come. And that'll do it for the South Florida Roundup this week. It is produced by Andrea Perdomo. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Lance Dixon is our digital editor. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's director of radio programming is Jason Zabka. The director of radio operations and the program's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, listening, and supporting WLRN. This program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.